So let's go right away to our next conversation this morning. And of course, you know, the International Committee of the Red Cross says its medical teams have performed over 1,000 surgeries on weapon-wounded patients in just 2 months. So the procedures took place at Akobo County Hospital and Juba Military Hospital, reflecting the ongoing toll of the violence on civilians.
So as needs arise, we take a close look at how the ICRC is responding on the ground and what this means for access to emergency care in conflict-affected regions. So we have two guests joining us now, Head of Operations at ICRC, Daniel Banskog, and our Deputy Health Coordinator, ICRC, Ros Ochieng. Daniel, good morning and welcome to Mirai. Sorry, Daniel. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Nice to be here. Thank you.
Yes, and Rose. We also have with us Ros Ochieng. Good morning.
Good morning, and thanks for having us.
Yeah, let's go right away to our discussions. You know, like we said earlier on, the ICRC recently performed over 1,000 surgeries, both in Akobo and also within Juba. And that's between the month of March and May alone. That is too much, yeah? So can you walk us through this whole process?
Yeah. Maybe I can start with that. And indeed, since the month of March, the ICRC in South Sudan has performed an increasing number of surgeries linked to people wounded in the violence and in the conflict. Actually, if we look from beginning of the year, we have more than doubled the number of surgeries compared to the same period last year. We are performing these surgeries and treatment of weapon wounded currently both in Juba, in collaboration with Juba Military Hospital, and in Akobo, with the Akobo County Hospital.
How were you able to respond to such a high demand, you know, and it must have been a bit overwhelming?
Indeed, it is not an easy process to reach the people wounded in very remote areas that are also insecure many of the times. So the ICRC... At one hand, we travel. We manage to go and collect patients from these areas using our air means. Of course, taking into consideration the security on the ground. This is being done very often, practically every day, across various parts of South Sudan. And in the last 2 months, 3 months, it's been particularly in northern Jongle, in Upper Nile, but also from other areas. In South Sudan, not necessarily linked to the escalating conflict, places such as Warap and the Equatorias. But we also rely on communities and the patients' coping mechanisms sometimes, and patients make their ways to the hospitals as well by their own means, which is positive when that is possible. And we work with partners, for example, with other humanitarian agencies such as MSF, who also sometimes brings patients to the ICRC-supported clinics and hospitals.
Okay. Rose, yes. With such a high number of surgeries carried out in a short period of time, how has the organization ensured that medical teams have the supplies they need, the staff they need, as well as the support to keep up with the demand?
Yeah, having emergency preparedness measures in place is also very key, because of the fact that every time we want to deploy, we have to make sure that we have enough supplies. We have staff on standby, in the country and outside the country. So what happened this time is that we had three teams in the country, and we also had a standby team in Nairobi. So it was very easy for us to be able to mobilize the team in Nairobi to join us. And for this, we had four teams in the country. So we had two teams in Juba Military Hospital and two teams in Akobo. For supplies, yes, we have our systems in place. We have weapon-wounded kits. One kit can handle about 50 patients. So the time we're deploying to the field, we sent two kits. So that is about 100 cases. And we monitor daily activities in the field by looking at the daily statistics. So we look at the daily statistics, we are able to monitor consumption, and with that, then we are able to replenish as quickly as we can. And then also because of the many challenges, especially during the rainy season, when a lot of flights cannot go to some remote places because the airstrips are not landable. So in such a scenario, what we do, we also have buffer stocks in the field so that we ensure that we do not run out of supplies.
All right. All right. That's interesting. And so, I mean, tell us if there are collaborative efforts between the ICRC and the local authorities in the areas and also other institutions, organizations to ensure the capacity of the medical facilities.
Yeah, definitely. We do not do this alone. We work very closely with the Ministry of Health. We work very closely with other implementing partners, MSF and the UNHAS, especially when we wanted to send, you know, a bulk of medical items. We used UNHAS flight. So it's a collaborative activities. For example, in Akobo, we have a doctor now who is an MOH doctor who's just assigned to Akobo recently, and he does not have any weapon wounded experience. So it's a very opportune time for him to come and join us and work very closely with us. So in the process, we work together and he also gets the skills. So in a situation like that, we are happy because of the fact that when we exit Akobo, we are sure that there's the skills that is left behind, so that in an event that weapon wounded comes after we exit, then of course we know they will be attended to. And not just in Akobo, not just the surgeons, we also work very closely with the nurses. We train them on you know, infection prevention measures, on wound dressing and, you know, all the other things that needs to be done. So we try to upskill their skills and just make sure that, you know, they have the skills that needs to address the needs of the wounded.
All right. Yep. Daniel, are there any success stories you can highlight, one or two of some of the, or a notable case that could maybe just give us a picture on the kind of impact that the surgical intervention is having on individual patients?
Yes. Well, first of all, you know, it's not a success that we have to treat weapon wounded, war wounded patients. It is reflecting the situation in the country. It's a sad fact. A key success story for me is every time when we manage to get out to a location and bring a patient to care as quickly as possible, sometimes within less than 24 hours to very remote places. Because the faster we can bring a patient to care, the bigger the chances that person can survive, or that person can have their limbs saved, for example, prevent an amputation. So these are successes every time, actually. We're very happy when we can manage to do those operations successfully. But maybe Rose can give us one or two examples of individual cases.
Yes, Rose. We have very specific. I mean, of course, we have so many success stories, like Daniel has mentioned. But two comes to my mind. We had one specific case in Rank of a young girl, of 17-year-old girl, who was attacked in Sudan. And they managed to get their way to Rank. And she had a very bad injury to the head. You know, and this is a very complex surgery that requires intensive care. And, of course, in the field, we do not have this kind of, we do not have access to this equipment that can manage these complex cases. And, of course, we could not fly this girl to Juba because of the fact she was not fit to fly. So what we did, we looked at the girl, we sat down with the parents, and we kind of took them through how complex this surgery may be. And maybe the outcome would not be as good as maybe would have wanted it. And they gave us the consent, and we went ahead and did it. And, we hoped and prayed that the recovery was going to be good, but it turned out to be better than we thought. So the 2 days later, this girl was up and about. She could sit. And, you know, when you look at a case like this, when, you know, almost everybody was giving up on her and just doing the bare minimum, and, you know, just to try and relieve the pain that she was going through. And then all of a sudden, she's fully recovered and she's able to move around. So this is really a success story for us. And we have many like this. Mm. In Akobo, for example, we also had a case of a 20-year-old boy who had multiple gunshot wounds to the abdomen. And, you know, he was brought in. He did not have any caretakers. He did not have any family with him. So we needed blood before we could take him to theater. But then there was nobody to give blood. And, you know, we kind of mobilized the community and they came together and we managed to get blood. So this also, you know, this also encourages us that, you know, every time, every place where we work, it is also really good to engage with the community, because the moment you engage with them, the respect and the acceptability is quite high. So they managed to give us blood and we were able to save a life. I mean, and stories like this are many, many, because of the fact that we embrace the community, we bring them to the decision-making table, and they accept us and, you know, their family.
Wow. Yeah. All right. There are always cases that happen like this, and when Besides the surgeries that were conducted, I believe these people went through a lot of psychological problems, and as a result of the post-traumatic stress disorders, mm-hmm. event that happened previously to their lives as a result of conflict. So how have you been able to support their psychological needs?
Yeah, you know, physical intervention is just a part of the healing journey, and mental health is also part of it. So they go hand in hand. So what we do in Akobo, we have a mental health and psychosocial support team, as well as in the Juba Military Hospital. So what they do is they walk the journey with the patients. I mean, healing, it's a conflict brings a lot of traumatic experience to the victims. It takes a very long time for them to heal. But, you know, the moment they're at their lowest, because the moment the pain is extremely fresh. So if you can take advantage of that moment, then you're able to walk the journey, and the recovery could be faster. So what we do, we give them space, you know, we talk to them, we guide them. And a lot of times they also come without family. So we also have to engage with the family back home, you know, just to ensure that they know the patient is doing well. They have to have links with their families. If it's a mother, she has to know how her kids are doing back home. The kids back home, the husband also would want to know how the wife is doing here. So this is also part of that mental health and psychosocial support that we give.
Okay.
In the process, we also have like small kids that also have very traumatic experiences. So what we do with the kids, you know, we also sometimes gather them, we give them like toys and plays, and, you know, sometimes we ask them to draw pictures, you know, just to relieve whatever it is that is inside them. And I can tell you sometimes when you sit down with these 7-12-year-old boys, what they have been through is extremely traumatic, even for the staff, listening to, you know, what the experiences that they had. So when they bring it out in pictures, when they draw their pictures, you know, one of them last week drew like an ambulance and with a doctor next to the ambulance. So we ask, why did you draw this? They said, okay, we drew this because when we came, ICRC was there to receive us, and ICRC saved our life. So when I grow up, I want to be a doctor. And then another one drew, a gun with somebody coming to their village to steal their cows, and, you know, his father was killed in the process. So, you know, it's just a way of them just to relieve whatever it is that is inside them for them to recover.
Wow, listening to this is both heartwarming mm-hmm. and heartbreaking. It's a very difficult place to be. Mm-hmm. Yes, I want to ask about something that comes with conflict. How do you manage to ensure that there's neutrality in terms of providing healthcare in such situations, and as well as protect the medical workers?
Yes. So, well, first of all, as ICRC mandated, but of course by the international community, we have a role to engage with all stakeholders, all those who carry weapons in any country, especially here in South Sudan. We do that in a bilateral and confidential manner, which means we are trying to, of course, build acceptance and understanding of our approach, that it is neutral, independent, and impartial, and that we want to provide treatment to any patient, regardless of his or her origin, affiliates, etc. And this is working well in South Sudan. The fact that today we are present in both Juba and in Akobo, where the patients can be treated safely in a safer environment, depending on where they are from, is a testimony to that. And actually, we were present as ICRC in Akobo for 6 years and left last year. And we supported this hospital for a very long time. And it was also based on the fact that it's important to be able to provide care in a location where the patients also can feel safe. Mm-hmm. And in the current context of an escalating conflict, it is important that we maintain that. But it comes through dialogue, and also the fact that ICRC, some things that we speak about are kept, of course, confidential. We don't voice them publicly. We have this approach that has proven itself over the last 160 years.
Mm. Now, with the pressure coming from the war in Sudan, we've seen a surge in the numbers of returnees and refugees. How is ICRC adjusting to this unprecedented escalation of needs for vulnerable people? And I wouldn't say adjusting, because this started in 2023. How have you managed since then?
Well, it's a good question, because it has been a very large portion of what we have been doing in South Sudan, including in 2024 and 2023, and now in 2025. ICRC has has been reaching South Sudanese, well, Sudan people returning or fleeing from Sudan, mainly in locations where they live in communities. This has been primarily in Upper Nile, Western Baragazal, Northern Baragazal, places where there are no mechanisms in place to cater for them. We have distributed emergency food and EHI, but also help with outreach in terms of primary healthcare in places such as Kodok and Upper Nile. Importantly as well, when people flee an ongoing conflict in a different country, people get separated from their families. They lose contact. And this we are continuing constantly and across the country with our teams traveling to various camps and locations to help people reconnect by providing them, means to do phone calls and also document things that have happened to them. Importantly, end of last year in December, there was also a large influx of wounded people coming from Sudan when the conflict in Sudan came very close to the South Sudanese borders. And then we deployed a team similar to what we have today in Renk, in Akobo. We deployed that to Renk at the time and also treated a lot of weapon wounded from the Sudanese conflict, which thankfully has decreased since then in terms of people coming to South Sudan. Mm. So we have a multidisciplinary wide approach to that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Maybe to wind up now with the increasing number of civilian casualties and from conflicts here in South Sudan particularly. So tell us what advocacy, the steps that you're taking SISCRC in order to promote the adherence to the international humanitarian law among the conflicting parties.
Yes. First of all, we have stepped up as ISCRC our dialogue with all the parties to the conflict since it escalated. Earlier this year, as I mentioned before, bilaterally and confidentially. We have also been quite vocal on our social media handles on principles of humanity and key principles of international humanitarian law, such as distinction and proportionality, which are concepts in terms of conducting military operations, which is very important for everybody to know. We have also, worked closely with the Ministry of Health last year, which is very relevant today, on a no weapons policy, which means that health facilities and health workers and people being treated in such structures are protected by international humanitarian law. It's something that we are promoting constantly by our teams in the field, but also more publicly through our social media handles and, of course, through bilateral confidential dialogue. It's not an effort that ISRC can do alone. These are universal concepts. Mm. And so we also support everybody else who is passing the same type of messages to protect health facilities and health workers and patients.
All right. Thank you so much, Daniel and Ross, for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very commendable work. Thank you for updating us. We'll definitely keep in touch for more updates. Well, we have the news headlines coming up next. Stay tuned.